This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A great day when Joe Biden seems to be doing everything he possibly can to avoid confronting what could be the defining fact of his administration. What is it? It's inflation. We'll speak to Peter Coy of the New York Times, who has written a powerful piece about how nothing else may matter at the end of the day when Joe Biden is facing voters in the midterm elections coming up a year from now, and ultimately if he faces the voters again in the presidential election of 2024. We will also bring you up to date on the closing arguments, which are just being made now. The prosecution is just finishing their closing argument in the Kyle Rittenhouse trial. And I do think that listening to the closing statement by the prosecutor, Dinger, the Binger is his name, and that it's not a clear-cut sort of automatic acquittal that that people were expecting after some much worse days for the prosecution earlier on. We will go to that. We'll go to the opening, at least, of the defense closing arguments coming up. But it's extraordinarily compelling, and it's very complex, because the real question that the trial may turn on is, was Kyle Rittenhouse, was he reasonable to fear for his life? Would someone actually watching that video, would somebody actually say, yes, he had no choice but to fire the AR-15 that he was carrying and to seriously wound one and to kill two others? One of the things that is, I'm actually eager to find out what happens in that, is not only what the verdict is, there are five charges that are left. The judge threw out in the last 24 hours the illegal possession of a gun charge. But is it likely that he will get either the maximum or the minimum, that he will either be totally exonerated or they'll throw the book at him? That seems to me to be unlikely. Here is a the way that Binger laid out his closing argument, and then I'll try to give you a quick summary of the rest. It's a long piece of oratory. Here is the prosecutor with the closing arguments, clip 19.
The defendant made a series of reckless decisions that night, going armed with an AR-15 at 17 years old when he knew he shouldn't have done so, because that gun is normally locked in a safe that he doesn't have access to, and it's not even legally his. He's out after a citywide curfew. He's intentionally and knowingly entering into a dangerous situation, and he expects it because he brings along his AR-15 and some body armor. So don't tell me you didn't know. He brings along no non-lethal means of defense, which means his only option is to kill. I don't know about a lot of you, but I remember that night. I didn't come down here. I don't think most reasonable people did, in part because we all knew it was going to be violent and dangerous. Most reasonable people, to the extent they came out, they were gone by then, because you don't willingly put yourself in this situation unless you want it, unless you're looking for it, unless you want trouble.
And then, of course, he showed previous postings on social media in which basically Kyle Rittenhouse had made a claim that he couldn't wait till he became famous, posing with his gun. He had gotten that gun and gone with the fellow who got it for him, who was of legal age, and they had fired off a bunch of rounds. This is long before he came down there for the riot. The one thing that I have to tell you is, honestly, it makes me physically ill to see footage of those riots that are going on there. One of the things that's fascinating, if you look at some of the details, if you look at some of the video that they were showing today at the courtroom, one of the points they had there is gas was about $2.29, I think they said, as of the price of gas. Kind of shows you how things have gone in our country in that regard. The sickening, just total chaos and total anarchy of people wandering the streets and cursing each other and shouting at each other and destroying property and lighting dumpster fires. And basically, Norman Mailer wrote a book about a demonstration in 1967 against the Vietnam War, the March on the Pentagon, called Armies of the Night. This is like Armies of the Night. This is people who are basically with no purpose, no organization, no direction, what they want, what they feel, what they're communicating. This lack of message on all sides of people who are full of hatred, it makes me think of those, frankly, awful sentiments that are occasionally even expressed by famous people. They're occasionally expressed by callers or guests on this show, that somehow we need a civil war, we need some kind of confrontation in America. If this is what it looks like, no sane person could want this. Not in your town, not anywhere in a country that we love. It's ugly beyond belief. And that's part of what Thomas Binger was trying to make clear today, that even though you may not like Joseph Rosenbaum, who was 5'4", who was muttering, who clearly had psychiatric issues, was a crazy little guy. He compared him, the prosecutor, to a barking little dog, yipping and yapping. And they showed footage of this bald and diminutive guy being pushed around, not by Kyle Rittenhouse or by people on the other side, but by people on his own side who found him annoying. And the fact is, though, that he had no weapons on him that night. He didn't come out there with weapons, just his mouth. There's also this, the claim that the real purpose that Kyle Rittenhouse was to come out and to serve as a medic. This is Prosecutor Binger on that claim. This is 19B.
So how do we evaluate the defendant's performance as a medic that night? Well, on one hand, he wrapped up an ankle and I think maybe helped somebody who got a cut on their hand. Yay. On the other hand, he killed two people, blew off Gage Grosskreutz's arm, and put two more lives in jeopardy. So, you know, when we balance your role as a medic that night, I don't give you any credit. He showed no remorse for his victims, never tried to help anybody that he hurt, and even on the witness stand, when he testified on Wednesday, he broke down crying about himself, not about anybody that he hurt that night. No remorse, no concern for anyone else.
And then, of course, in the dramatic footage, they show Kyle Rittenhouse, who's now 18, reacting to some of the fairly tough words of the prosecution. Fairly tough words, the guy's on trial for murder, for the death of two people. And I do think it's going to be very, very difficult to argue persuasively that the right outcome here would be either execution or life imprisonment on the one hand, or a simple exoneration and release, a full acquittal of all charges on the other. And there probably will be civil charges brought against him by some of the families of the victims. We will be speaking later on about the secret of Tom Brady's success and a big new college may it be successful. Coming up on the MedVed Show. MedVed Show, they are in recess right now in the trial of Kyle Rittenhouse. And the defense is about to give its closing. which I'm sure will also be very well rehearsed and well organized and well practiced and persuasive. In a case that I do think one of the reasons that the case has riveted the country and drawn so much attention is really because there are arguments on both sides. It is not a slam dunk. And again, what Thomas Binger was saying toward the end of his case about him being a medic and trying to balance the situation as it was there. The one thing that's very, very hard-hitting when you actually watch the video and watch a bunch of it, and they were showing a bunch of video today, is that it's not like a movie, an entertainment movie, a Hollywood movie. When you describe something like a riot, you expect things to happen, bang, 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 bang. This is not that. This is not a big, thrilling, action-packed, stunt-ridden confrontation. Because what happens is he falls down. He's being chased, and he has an open gun. The one of the people confronting him, Mr. Huber, was there with a skateboard that he was trying to hit him with, but not succeeding terribly well. And then there was Gage Grossbart, who did have a gun, but took a while to take his gun out. And though he was pointing it in the general direction of Kyle Rittenhouse, I think there are going to be arguments at the jury and with the jury about how directly he was really pointing it. And they'll ask to see the video again and again and again, I'm sure, when they're in the jury room. And the point being that a great deal of this was when Rittenhouse was on the ground and he was trying to get away. He was not clearly going after people to try to kill them. But then the question becomes, it was his decision to bring a very potent weapon, a very serious weapon, and to bring it to a situation in which he knew to be violent. The idea that he was helping the police or that the police wanted his help is probably not going to hold up. Here was that Thomas Binger, the prosecutor, again, as part of his summary for the jury. Listen.
So, how do we evaluate the defendant's performance as a medic that night? Well, on one hand, he wrapped up an ankle and I think maybe helped somebody who got a cut on their hand. Yay. On the other hand, he killed two people, blew off Gage Grosskreutz's arm, and put two more lives in jeopardy. So, you know, when we balance your role as a medic that night, I don't give you any credit. He showed no remorse for his victims, never tried to help anybody that he hurt, and even on the witness stand, when he testified on Wednesday, he broke down crying about himself, not about anybody that he hurt that night. No remorse, no concern for anyone else.
And again, does he have some way of knowing that? Well, of course he doesn't. He's not a mind reader. But can he assume that? Is it legal for him to make that kind of statement when he is trying to persuade a jury? Is it even relevant that he has no remorse? It may not be relevant in determining guilt or innocence, but it certainly is going to be relevant in terms of determining any sympathy from the jury. 1-800-955-1776 is our phone number. One of the things that I find most revolting about this entire trial and the coverage about it and the concerns that that people have about this trial and the fascination they have with it is the idea of trying to make it into a racial issue. Karen Bass, the member of Congress from California, she was one of those people who was on the short list for Biden for vice president, I'll bet he wishes he had taken somebody else other than Kamala Harris. But here was Karen Bass trying to explain why she and others believe that where all the principals are white. I mean, all the principals. And again, it seems very difficult when you're looking at people's motivations or who they are or how the crimes happened or any other aspect of it. It's very difficult to imagine how you can try to make it a racial issue or a race trial, but Karen Bass does it. Listen.
Kyle Rittenhouse is a white man who's accused of shooting and three other white men and other white killing two
right.
of them. Explain how you think there's a racial dimension to this case.
Well, because remember now, where were those white men that were killed? They were at a protest, protesting in solidarity for black folks. So to me, it was reminiscent of the civil rights movement when you had young white people that participated in the sit-ins and the protests, and they were subject to beatings, they were subject to shootings, many of them were killed as well. And it's as though the judge is taking that very lightly. Remember, the judge in Rittenhouse case said you couldn't even refer to the people that were killed as victims. You could refer to them as rioters.
Okay, this is, that's not exactly the idea that you couldn't refer to them as victims. It was basically using that word. He found, and I don't know what the general rule is in Wisconsin courtrooms, but that idea about not referring to the people as victims, when the case is a case of self-defense, when the question is who initiated the violence, and that was certainly a question that the defense was trying to stress, was to make the case that no, it was actually the victims, or not to use that word, the people who were shot who initiated the violence, and in that sense they weren't victims, they were full participants, they were in fact initiators. Okay, does that mean that he would only do that, not treat them as victims because they were white? I honestly the notion here that it is racism that would lead him to favor Kyle Rittenhouse at the same time that racism played no role in his favoring or giving equal consideration to the people that Kyle Rittenhouse killed. The entire thing is so twisted and so irrational. Speaking of twisted and irrational, there's Biden's economic policy. We will get to that and to more on The Michael Medved Show. And on The Michael Medved Show, while we are awaiting the latest dramatic developments, and they're pretty dramatic today because of the last day, they're going to the jury today, with the Kyle Rittenhouse trial, there's much more going on. The fate of a presidency is at stake. So writes Peter Coy of the New York Times. And the New York Times, as we've mentioned on the show before, has not been apologetic or defensive or protective at all of the Biden administration, as I think many conservatives believe that it would. The piece today by Peter Coy, who writes about economics for Opinion and who spent 32 years writing for Business Week and its successor Bloomberg Business Week before that, writes about how inflation may be the defining factor in the entire Biden administration. And the big question, Peter, is what can the president do about it? Because he doesn't want an administration defined by rising inflation. I think it's safe to assume.
That is very safe to assume. No president does. And the problem for any president, Republican, Democrat, is that they don't completely control the economy. They have much less influence for good or ill than people tend to assume. So So, you know, Clinton gets huge credit for the boom we had at the end of the 90s. You know, name your president. Herbert Hoover gets blamed for the Depression. And there are certainly good or bad policies that any president can pursue. But to pin any success or failure just on the president alone is just wrong economics. Now, in the particular case of Biden, if you're going to say that he's responsible for the inflation, you would say, well, there is a case to be made that a lot of the aid that went into the economy to save us from the pandemic helped people put more money in their pockets and allowed them to spend more. Meanwhile, the supply was not rising in line, so it's a classic case of too much money chasing too few goods produces higher prices. And I think there is some truth to that. It doesn't mean it was the wrong thing to do to help people out from the damage done by the brief recession we had last year.
What about the idea, and I think many Americans believe this, and not just conservatives by any means, that there is a connection between inflationary pressure and very high, very punishing deficits and rising numbers almost to unbelievable levels of the national debt, and that all we've had from the Biden administration has been an attempt to spend more money. Is it fair to make that association?
Well, the connection would be a little bit like what I was saying, is like if there's a lot of spending, that implies deficits, right? You're spending out more than you're taking in taxes. You're injecting money into the economy that goes into people's pockets. And especially because most of the aid went to people of poor and lower middle income, rather than the rich. And those people have a higher propensity to spend. You give them $100, they'll spend a higher percentage of that than if you give it to some rich person. So it has more economic impact, which when the economy is running slowly is a good thing. When the economy starts to get hot, the way it has been lately, it's less of a good thing. You can overstimulate an economy, and that's when you start getting higher prices.
So basically there's pieces everywhere today about your other alternative news source. The Wall Street Journal has a big piece today by Catherine Lucy and Alex Leary, climbing prices push Biden to adjust his message.
Yeah.
And what's the adjustment mean? It means that he's no longer saying this is just transitory, it's just nothing, it's going away. But what can any president or Secretary of the Treasury or Federal Reserve head do to actually slow the inflation?
Right. Well, the message I think Biden is trying to deliver now is that there are benefits to some of these bills that will help the supply side of the economy. That'll increase the supply of goods and services rather than this demand for them. If you increase supply, that tends to help curb inflation. So that's the new messaging coming out of the White House. The problem is that it's not quick fix. For example, if you take measures that will help create a stronger workforce, get more people working, but it takes years to do that, it's good. You want to do that. We should be doing it, but it's not going to help solve the high burst of inflation we're having right now. But to answer your broader question, like what can the president do, that's back to where we started, is, not a lot. It would be, I think nobody would be happy if Congress or the White House decided, okay, we better curb consumer demand by raising taxes, for example. That would not be popular, even though it probably would be effective in curbing inflation.
Or raising interest rates usually curbs inflation.
Raising interest rates, of course, that's the Federal Reserve. That's under Jerome Powell. One decision for Biden is whether to reappoint Jay Powell as Fed chair when his term expires early next year. I don't really see Biden replacing Powell with a more hawkish person that is somebody who would be more likely to put the screws on inflation. If anything, he might choose a more dovish sort of person, you know.
Lael Brainard, or?
Lael Brainard, yes, exactly, would be, is the other name that gets bruited about, a Democrat rather than Powell being a Republican.
What about wind buttons? Is that going to, I'm old enough to remember how embarrassing
that was. I am too, Michael,
was.
Yeah.
I mean, that was President Ford whipping inflation,
right?
Now.
Yeah.
We're not going to see
inflation now. Yeah, that was not super successful, I think you remember.
No, it was embarrassing beyond belief. But
yeah.
But then again, particularly on this issue, do you believe that, as some people suggest, that there will be more stability and that there will be less demand supply dysfunction, disconnection, once the pandemic really does begin to recede and people feel that we're not in such an emergency situation anymore?
I do feel that way. You know, I've been talking sort of a pessimistic tone here, but I do believe that we had 6.something% inflation in October. That's not going to continue. I mean, one thing that people forget is that if today's high prices just stayed, you know, nothing fell back, gasoline did not go back to where it was, or, you know, used car prices did not fall back, they just, everything stayed where it was for the next 12 months, the inflation rate for the coming year would be zero, because inflation is an increase in prices, not just high prices. So for you to worry about and very high inflation, it means you're betting that there's just going to be an upward spiral rather than just continuing high prices. And I just don't think, I don't see that. I think inflation could stay somewhat higher than 2%, but I don't think it's going anywhere where it was in October.
Okay, very briefly, what should Republicans say that might actually be credible and helpful?
What could Republicans say or do that would be helpful on inflation?
Yep.
Tough one. I'd say, you know, you want to pass legislation that's going to help on the supply side of the economy, increasing supply of goods and services, not just the demand.
Look, that's a really great, really useful, basic outline of the dilemma we face. And when I say we face it, it's the whole country. It's not just Joe Biden. Though, of course, a lot of people trying to use the Let's Go Brandon rally to try to express their feelings about Joe Biden and other feelings about religion and religious exclusivity. We'll get to that controversy coming up. And what's interesting about the trial, many things are interesting about it, but one of the things that's interesting is they're holding the trial just feet away from where these killings took place. Mark Richards, the defense attorney or the lead defense attorney for Kyle Rittenhouse, is making his summation. Let's tune in.
Police have an easier job because scene one and scene two would have been put in the same location. My client ran two blocks without shooting at anyone, pointing at anyone, doing anything to try and get away. He tells the individuals he's going to the police and he's running in that direction when he stopped. He's hit in the head with a hand with a rock in it, knocking his hat off. Mr. Binger says, oh, he just knocked his hat off. I don't think that individual was trying to steal Mr. Rittenhouse's hat. He was trying to take his head off. Who comes in next? Anthony Huber, for the first time. Hits him. Opening statement, Mr. Binger, was he takes a swing at him. Now it's he blocked because we took the videotape and lightened it up. Huber strikes him in the head and arm the first time. Jump kick man comes in, kicks him in the face, spins his body 180 degrees, and Anthony Huber comes in for the second lick to the shoulder neck area, trying to take his head off. And when he does that, his other hand goes grabbing for the gun, his bare hand onto the gun and pulling it away from Kyle Rittenhouse. Mr. Binger wants Kyle to sit there and hope and pray to God his strap works and Anthony Huber can't get the gun. We don't know that. We'll never know that as he's running away from him. A shot as the gun is being separated from his body, and you'll see the butt way far away when the shot is finally fired. Even Gage Grosskwitz said he was concerned about the blows that Jump Kick Man and Anthony Huber were inflicting on Kyle's head. That's probably the only thing I agree with Mr. Grosskwitz. Gage Grosskwitz. The state must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that what Kyle did under those facts and circumstances was unreasonable, that he was not entitled to self-defense. Consider all the events that had occurred that evening, him being attacked, kicked in the head, hit in the head with a skateboard, other individuals running up on him, and now Mr. Grosskwitz runs up on him. And the first action of Mr. Grosskwitz, and I'll go through the video later, is really he's running in, the hand is coming up, and the gunshot with Huber goes off. And the natural reaction is the flinch. He covers up. And then he pulls his hands up. And as he's standing with his hands up, look, he's not gripping the gun anymore in a pistol grip. Hands apart, hands up. And as he comes in to finish the job, the hand is on the gun going for Mr. Rittenhouse.
We're listening to the closing statement for the defense by attorney Mark Richards in the Kyle Rittenhouse case in Kenosha. Listen.
It's coming, the shot, and it continues on with that momentum. Enough momentum to go through the bullet and point directly at Kyle's head. Does Kyle fire again? No, he doesn't. Actions likely to cause death or great bodily harm. And he is coming in with a loaded Glock. And we asked Mr. Gage Grosskwitz about it. He wouldn't even admit that there was one in the chamber. That's why we had to put on the officer to talk about the unfired shell casing. Lukowski talked about clearing the weapon and a live round coming out. Because Grosskwitz won't say anything that puts him in a bad light. Grosskwitz, the person who has 10 million reasons to lie. And we all know he did lie, because he never gave a new interview after giving a statement saying he dropped his gun going down the street. Ladies and gentlemen, those are the charges. Those are a synopsis of the charges. As I stated, the burden is on the state, and they must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that my client did not have the right to self-defense. Kyle, as he sits here, is presumed innocent of all charges. If there is any reasonable hypothesis to reconcile with Kyle's innocence, that is what you are to choose. Remember, when looking at the burden of proof, they have it. Think about some of the things, the shoddy investigation, the rush to judgment from the Kenosha District Attorney's Office, the Zeminskis not being called as witnesses. They have the burden of proof. We don't.
I think that one of the things that he is likely to hit here as he's winding up, and he may have hit it already while we were on the air on other things, is the weakest part of Prosecutor Binger's summation was he was trying to say that the other people who were there in Kenosha that night, the people who were rioting, the people who were leading to the third night of property destruction and civil chaos and violence, that they have rights too. And of course they do. But he was saying they have rights to defend themselves against Kyle Rittenhouse, because he may have maintained that he was coming there for good intentions, but he was armed, he had partial body armor, he was prepared for the worst, And what he was saying was that basically when they were running after him, they were running after someone that looked to be a danger to them. In other words, trying to imply that there was a right of self-defense that was being exercised by the people who were shot by Kyle Rittenhouse. Now, that's a stretch. And he also tried to make the people who were rioting that night seem harmless, seem basically innocent, trying to exercise their First Amendment rights and then their right of self-defense when they're chasing the guy down the street. And this is the point that Andy McCarthy makes, and I think it's profound, it's important, and probably the result will at least partially depend on that and turn on that. The idea that Kyle Rittenhouse was trying at the point that the actual deadly shooting began, he was trying to get away from trouble, not going toward it. It's hard to see that he wanted to get into a confrontation where both Mr. Huber and both Joseph Rosenbaum were struggling with him to get control of the gun, that was not a situation that Kyle Rittenhouse would have or certainly should have welcomed. We will see. I have no idea, and neither does anyone else, how long the jury will go out. But you can see with people in the country, and I do think this is a reassuring development, is that what you have here, no one can point to this trial and say it was completely stacked on one side. It was completely unfair. It was completely wrong. I'm sure there are people who will quibble with and protest the verdict. I am virtually certain, as a number of legal experts have said, that regardless of what the verdict is, they can still pursue a civil trial and basically establish some liability for the Rittenhouse family and for doesn't have a great deal of funds, but they've been able to raise a great deal of money for their own defense, and I believe a $2 million bail at one point that was there for Kyle Rittenhouse. So that remember, the same thing happened after O.J. Simpson. When O.J. Simpson was let off, the family of Nicole Brown Simpson and of Peter, the other victim, Goldman, I forget what his name was, but they sued and they won against O.J. So is that something that will be happening here? Almost certainly. Something that also happened today was a verdict, a very harsh verdict, concerning one of America's more controversial talk show hosts. We will get to that. And a statement by a former top Trump aide that America should have only one religion. Really? We'll get to that and more in this greatest nation on God's green earth.